the Word and Texts, Hebrew Bible, 1 Samuel 3, verses 1 to 20. The boy Samuel ministered before the Lord under Eli. In those days, the word of the Lord was rare. There were not many visions. One night, Eli, whose eyes were becoming so weak that he could barely see, was lying down in his usual place. The lamp of God had not yet gone out, and Samuel was lying down in the house of the Lord, where the ark of God was. Then the Lord called Samuel. Samuel answered, "Here I am." And he ran to Eli and said, "Here I am, you called me." But Eli said, "I did not call. Go back and lie down." So he went and lay down. Again, the Lord called Samuel. And Samuel got up and went to Eli and said, "Here I am, you called me." "My son," Eli said, "I did not call. Go back and lie down." Now Samuel did not yet know the Lord. The word of the Lord had not yet been revealed to him. A third time, the Lord called Samuel. And Samuel got up and went to Eli and said, "Here I am, you called me." Then Eli realized that the Lord was calling the boy. So Eli told Samuel, "Go and lie down, and if he calls, you say, 'Speak, Lord, for your servant is listening.'" So Samuel went and lay down in his place. The Lord came and stood there, calling, as at the other times, "Samuel, Samuel." Then Samuel said, "Speak, for your servant is listening." And the Lord said to Samuel, "See, I am about to do something in Israel that will make the ears of everyone who hears about it tingle. At that time, I will carry out against Eli everything I spoke against his family from beginning to end. For I told him that I would judge his family forever because of the sin he knew about. His sons blasphemed God, and he failed to restrain them. Therefore, I swore to the house of Eli, the guilt of Eli's house will never be atoned for by sacrifice or offering." Samuel lay down until morning, then opened the doors of the house of the Lord. He was afraid to tell Eli the vision. But Eli called him and said, "Samuel, my son." Samuel answered, "Here I am." "What was it he said to you?" Eli asked. "Do not hide it from me. May God deal with you, be it ever so severely, if you hide from me anything he told you." So Samuel told him everything, hiding nothing from him. Then Eli said, "He is the Lord. Let him do what is good in his eyes." The Lord was with Samuel as he grew up, and he let none of Samuel's words fall to the ground. And all Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, recognized that Samuel was attested as a prophet of the Lord. The Lord continued to appear at Shiloh, and there he revealed himself to Samuel through his word. And from the Gospel, John 1, 43 to 50. The next day, Jesus decided to leave for Galilee. Finding Philip, he said to him, "Follow me." Philip, like Andrew and Peter, was from the town of Bethsaida. Philip found Nathanael and told him, "We have found one Moses wrote about in the law, and about whom the prophets also wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." "Nazareth, can anything good come from here, from there?" Nathanael asked. "Come and see," said Philip. When Jesus saw Nathanael approaching, he said of him, "Here truly is an Israelite in whom there is no deceit." "How do you know me?" Nathanael asked. Jesus answered, "I saw you while you were still under the fig tree before Philip called you." Then Nathanael declared, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." Jesus said, "You believe because I told you I saw you under the fig tree. You will see greater things than that." And the contemporary reading, "Change Can Be Unpredictable" by Niall Ferguson from complexity and collapse. The political and economic structures made by humans share many of the features of complex adaptive systems, whether the canopy of a rainforest or the trading floor of Wall Street. Complex systems share certain characteristics. A small input to such a system can produce huge, often unanticipated changes, what scientists call the amplifier effect. Causal relationships are often non-linear, which means that traditional methods of generalizing through observations are of little use. Some theorists of complexity say that complex systems are wholly non-deterministic, meaning that it is impossible to make predictions about their future behavior based on existing data. When things go wrong in a complex system, the scale of disruption is nearly impossible to anticipate. For the word in Scripture, for the word among us, for the word within us, we give thanks.
Perhaps it was the culmination of all the busyness of November and December and the leading up to Christmas, and then the new year always seems to give the opportunity to reflect and to take stock. And that got me thinking, trying to make some sense about what was happening in our community. And I think more importantly, what were some of the implications of what had been happening, especially the changes that we had experienced over last year and the months before that, and the changes that are likely to happen in the future and how they will impact on us. So, an unusual question I found came to me when I was thinking about all this, and it was, what would I be prepared to die for? When we think of these issues, I pondered on that and puzzled on that. Maybe it came to me because on November the 27th of last year, it was exactly 100 years since my great uncle Thomas Hawthorne, who had been a member of St. Andrew's in Hastings, was killed in France. And on that day, Jen and I took the time to go to what is a really quite fabulous exhibition at the National War Memorial and took some time to think about what had happened, why people had gone to war, why they had been prepared to die for that, and all the complexity around that. And so, whilst being prepared to die is certainly the end point, I got thinking, well, what are some of the things that lead up to that? My starting point was to reflect on just how fortunate I had been for the very nearly 8 decades in which I have lived here in New Zealand, and the opportunities that we have had and the progress that has been made over that time. But we have experienced changes in this last 20 years or so. And so some of them have given us cause for real concern, and all the indicators are that in the future there will be more and more changes and more complex. In what I consider to be an absolutely excellent book, Colin James, the New Zealander, entitled it Unquiet Times, Aotearoa New Zealand in a Fast-Changing World. And he says that in the world of the 2010s has become considerably disordered. He mentions, for example, the fact that the major powers are competing with each other in both geoeconomic and geopolitical terms. They are striving to influence other places in this world. The Arab region is in conflict and in turmoil. There is widespread retreat from the concept of freer trade. And in Europe and the United States, popular ferment has created considerable uncertainty in terms of the outcome of elections. And their societies in both the UK and the US are going through somewhat of a major transformation. Then on the other side, the economic, the social, and the political tensions within China are creating problems for the technocrats there. And the observation is that internationally, the finance and financial systems are overheated and fragile. What a mix. And Colin James highlights the fact that he identifies four major drivers of this disorder. Firstly, there is the whole thing of globalization. Instead of nation states and discrete states, we are now much more a global entity. Secondly, there is the coming age of digital technology, which is transforming communication on the one hand, and we've experienced that in terms of smartphones and Skype and all of those things. It's doing things with finance. Banks are closing branches and there is internet banking. It's doing things in terms of buying and selling and everyday life. The big report of the convention in Las Vegas said that now we have fridges, refrigerators, that will be able to sense what is in them and will able be to send to your smartphone details of what is becoming to its best before date and has to be used, and even creating recipes by which you can utilize the things that are most nearly running out of time in your refrigerator. Digital technology. The third thing that Colin mentions is the environmental limits, and particularly the shortage of water as the population of the world increases, and secondly, of course, in that era, climate change and the huge impact that we are experiencing of that. And the fourth, which is an outcome of those three, is this concept of a distinctive shock. The global financial crisis of the 2007-2008 rocked not only people, but economies and systems and procedures in a quite different way. And the world has not found really what is the new normality of some of these things. And so all of these adds up to a significant transformation in our society. What does that mean for us here in New Zealand, a tiny little country existing here at the bottom, we think, of the globe? How are we going to navigate ourselves through the 2020s and beyond? In many systems, the criteria for measuring progress has been the gross domestic product, the measurement of services produced and services consumed by the people of that environment. But the challenge comes as to whether that of itself is a sufficient measure of the total well-being of our society and our community. I was interested to read that back some years ago now, in actually fact, Treasury developed a new concept of economic well-being, and it really had a number of things that came into a living standards framework, which centered on four essential things, yeah, they called them four essential capitals, but that's all right. And they were firstly economic, secondly natural, thirdly social, and fourthly human. And I think that gives us a much better framework for us to think about those things. One of the things that we tend to feel is part of New Zealand society is that people had a fair go. And for most of the 70 or so years in the past, that has been reasonable. But I think in the last 10, 15 years, we have seen that degenerate in terms of the extension of inequalities between the haves and the have-nots, the difference of levels of remuneration for example, chief executives as opposed to staff in the different enterprises. And that is of quite a real concern as to whether this is achieving really what we want in terms of establishing welfare for our people in a sense of justice and fairness. But I think understanding the last few years has been quite a challenge in a number of different ways. We think, firstly, of the decisions of the people in the United Kingdom in terms of the Brexit decision to leave the European Community. And then on the other side of the Atlantic, the decisions of the US people in terms of the presidential election in 2016. In another book that I found and read recently, Naomi Klein makes the case in the title of her book, No is Not Enough. The word no is not enough in terms of changing some of these things in order to defeat what she writes about as the shock politics that is prevailing in a number of situations. Her main thesis is that American financial interests have used crises, some of which have been created by their own people, to benefit hugely at the expense of the local people. The first thing that she identifies is, for example, in Chile after the coup of Augusto Pinochet. Then what happened in Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And then in Baghdad, when the US implied their shock and awe regime. And on the home front, in New Orleans after the Katrina hurricane. The terms of shock doctrine she describes as brutal tactics for systematically using the public's disorientation because of the event of the time to allow benefit to be made from them in a most unkind and unclear way. And she goes on to list at length some of the changes that have happened, particularly after the appointment by President Trump of the members of his cabinet and the financial interests that they have, and the fact that in this regime there is an absolutely brazen ignorance of the whole thing of conflict of interest and of the benefit that is being made by these people in those things. And the impact that that is having on the way in which they reduce the influence and the right of the public service, the particular special legislation that they create, and it is really very disturbing. So, what do we think of these things in terms of the readings that Tony read to us and that Colmar had also referred to in this morning? The young Samuel, hearing his name, called. But it finds it was not Eli, the old man, that was calling him. And so, having gone to him the two times, Eli encourages him to respond, "Speak, for your servant is listening." And the message that came to him was, "See, I am about to do something in Israel that will make the ears of everyone who hears it tingle. I am about to punish Eli's house forever for the iniquity he knew because his sons were blaspheming God and he did not restrain them. The iniquity of that house will not be expiated by any sacrifice or offering whatsoever." That was long ago now, some 3,000 years since that conversation took place. What might we make of it in terms of some of the abuses and absurdities and extravagances that we see being propagated in our society and in the United States society and in other societies today? And then there was the reading from John's Gospel. And I emphasize that the two readings were both from the lectionary, not from my choice. Philip saying to Nathanael, "We have found him about whom Moses and the law and the prophets wrote. He is Jesus, son of Joseph of Nazareth." And then, of course, the comment of, well, what good could ever come out of Nazareth? But then when Jesus saw Nathanael coming towards him, he said to him, "Here is truly an Israelite in whom there is no deceit." Nathanael asked him, "Where did you get to know me?" Jesus answered, "I saw you under the fig tree before Philip called you." This one, a statement from some 2,000 years ago. Here we are in our time of tremendous changes and tremendous challenges. One of the aspects that attracted Jen and I to come back to St. Andrews on the Terrace last year was the commitment of this congregation has to the valuing of people, people of all persuasions, of all ethnicities, of all circumstances and all situations. But not only that concept, your willingness to take a lead in taking a stand for justice and for the important issues, and the way in which you are able to encourage others to join with you, with us. So I come back to my question of what sorts of things are out there that I might even be prepared to die for? What is it that we really value? And I think that we must continue to work positively in whatever ways we can to maintain our values and to convince others that accepting and supporting them in ways that we can work at to enhance people's understanding of the justice that is there in the gospel, and that we need to do this at whatever the cost. So may it be for us. Let us sing our special hymn, and after the singing of the hymn, please remain standing as we say together our affirmation of faith, which is in our orders of service.